VanWee Financial is a registered investment advisor. Information presented is for educational purposes only and does not intend to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies. Investments involve risk and, unless otherwise stated, are not guaranteed. Be sure to first consult with a qualified financial advisor and or tax professional before implementing any strategy discussed herein. It's Saturday morning. It's 10 o'clock. This is the VanWee Financial Hour. I'm Steve VanWee.
And I'm Adam VanWee.
And it is the 29th day of June, meaning the last show in the first half of this month.
First half of this year.
And I ask the question I ask so often, where did it go?
I don't know.
You know,
it went fast.
Yeah, it's official now. It is closer to next Christmas than last Christmas. That's how you know that time is really flying.
Wait, is that true? It's only the...
June to December.
Yeah, but we're still in June.
Yeah, June to December, 6 months.
Yeah, okay. That's true. I gotcha.
Yeah, I know what you're thinking.
Yeah, I gotcha.
Although thinking has little to do with it. We have a phone call that's only labeled Riverview. There's no name on it. And no, then we're not going to take it. Alan just... waved us off. I don't know what that's all about. Anyway, where was I? Oh, yes. Welcome to our regulars. Thanks for always being here. You're the reason we get up every day and do this, of course. And to the new people, if you're just driving by and happen to have your radio on, or if somebody's told you about it or you caught the website or anything like that, welcome. Stick around for the hour if you can. You're bound to learn something one way or the other. And for people who have any idea at all what we do day to day, it's not radio. We're not the make your living on radio types of people, but we do manage other people's money and we do comprehensive financial planning. We probably don't talk enough about our day jobs, but if you check our website, VanWee Financial, you can find all kinds of interesting information. We update our blog sheets very frequently with some things that are going on and ideas, concepts, and all that. So more than just a couple of pretty faces on the radio, right?
Yeah, debatable.
Anyway.
But not having a phone call does mean that lines are open.
Yes, so lines are open.
We really have a lot to talk about today, but we much prefer to answer your questions.
Absolutely.
It makes for a better show, so give us a call.
904-222-TALK, 222-8255. Yeah, golly, the market, for some reason, and I kind of like to find a simple feeling type word about the week that we've had the market, for some reason... it was a down week, but it felt kind of good.
Yep, I completely agree.
In fact, I was very surprised when I closed out the week's numbers last night. I start preparing for the show after the market closes on Friday nights, and I looked at them and, really?
Well,
all three indices were down a little?
I have a rule, and it actually applies to day by day. If the market is up or down less than 1%, I call it flat. So this week... for the entire week, the market was down less than 1%. So if that rule applies to a day, it certainly applies to a week.
But less than 0.5%.
Well, no. The S&P was down almost a full point, and the NASDAQ as well. The Dow was only off about 0.5%.
That's not the numbers I have.
Oh, well, you messed it up then. But yeah, regardless of how you did it or how you calculated it, it was a very flat week. Not much happened. I think the Dow was off 160 points, and that was, I think, 80 of those, or more than 80 of those, were attributable to Boeing
and the
problems they're having.
Yeah, just what they needed, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Another problem in the 737s.
Well, they really need to get that figured out.
They really do. And that shows you, no matter how big you are, you can't be careful enough. Me dealing with public safety and all that stuff.
Oh, man.
Somebody railroaded through some engineering there, and I guarantee you that before this thing's over, that somebody's going to be working somewhere else, not at all, or counting the days till he gets out of jail.
I am a mechanical engineer. I could have gone into that field. This is one of the major reasons I did not want to go in that field. I couldn't live with myself if something like that happened. How awful.
And somebody knew. I promise you, somebody knew.
Yeah.
That's the part that bothers me.
anyways, but yeah, it was actually a flat week. And the first half of 2019 was not flat. However, it was really, really good. And it was up, depending on which index you look at, the Dow was up almost 14%, the S&P up almost 17%, and the NASDAQ just under 20% for the first half of the year. Pretty crazy numbers.
And to our June 1st caller, who will get a definite answer as to whether or not pulling out of the market before June 1st was a good idea, 1 month down, 7%.
7%, yeah.
So
yeah.
It's not a conclusion yet. But your tracking index is looking pretty strong.
Yeah. So anyways, it's despite the kind of trail off at the end of this month, it looked pretty good. And I think what happened was people are just a little bit apprehensive going into this weekend about the meeting between Trump and the leader of China. I'm not even going to try and say his name because I always screw it up. But we all know who I'm talking about.
G. I just keep it to the
surname. Looks like XI. I don't know. But anyway, some good news came out about that last night. According to the Wall Street Journal this morning, President Trump allowed companies to do business with Huawei in exchange for China buying large amounts of American farm products. Now, there's no definition around large amount yet, but you have to assume that it was substantial.
When you're dealing with a customer base of 1.1 billion people,
right,
it could be big.
In addition, trade negotiations will resume, and the threatened 25% tariffs on $300 billion of additional Chinese goods were put off indefinitely. And this all happened over an 80-minute lunch break at the G20 summit. So that's a pretty quick negotiation. It almost feels like maybe it was preordained or pre-negotiated.
No good leader ever walks into a room with somebody that powerful without the pre-negotiation having been almost handshake.
Yeah, wink, wink, handshake.
Exactly.
Done.
You see the firepower around that table at lunch?
Pretty crazy.
Wow.
Yeah, definitely.
Who's who in the zoo, baby?
So I expect that there will be a positive reaction to that next week in the market, but again, who can predict these things? It might already be priced in.
Well,
I don't know.
The various estimates on Chinese growth rate for GDP lately are running between -1 and +1.
Ouch, down from 7 to 10.
Down from 11 to 10 to 7 to now -1 to +1. And nobody feels that heat more than Xi does.
No doubt about it. So despite all of that, money is actually pouring into bond mutual funds and ETFs right now and draining out of domestic stock funds. Which are going up, exactly. We just hit a new all-time high recently. We're a little bit off that. We almost closed the week there. It's nuts. Global equities are pretty steady as far as money flows, but investors, individual investors in particular, are increasingly moving money to the bond market, which is driving those prices up and yields down. Of course, the contrarians that we are says buy more domestic equity.
Yeah, and the Fed, despite everybody's certainty that the Fed's going to lower rates, Adam and I are both absolutely convinced that that is not going to be the case.
Still nothing out there besides maybe a little bit of new inflation data that would even, I don't know, I just don't see it.
You can take very careful aim and shoot yourself in the foot if you go by market expectations for things like that. The market is not right about the economy. And I blame the idiots in the media 100%. If you just sit and listen to the news on anything, including Fox, but if you eliminate them, then it's 100%, you'd swear this country is going to hell in a handbasket economically. And if you are the kind of person who watched any of the debates this week, this economy just isn't working.
Well, that's the base assumption of every candidate out there.
It's not working, people?
I have some data that would say otherwise. We'll talk about it after
the break. That's more on the other side. We've got to take a quick break. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. This is the Van Lee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Lee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Lee.
And I'm Adam Van Lee.
And we have a trivia question brought to you, as always, by Ken Bales at First Coast Alarm. Call Ken at 904-636-7888. My big topic for later in the show today is going to be a discussion of indexing of capital gains. It's an old idea that's been around for a long time, on and off, never quite got any traction in Congress. And all it means is when you sell something for more than you paid for it, you get a gain on the sale if you sell it for more. So that gain then is taxable to the person depending on the length of the holding period and so on. But if you hold something during a period of any length where inflation contributes to the rise in cost, you can possibly sell something showing a capital gain. I'm going to explain all this more, but where actually the 100% of the gain was caused just by the inflation of the price of your car, house, stock, whatever it is. So they're looking to index that to avoid taxation of the inflation factor. That's called indexing the capital gains. Now, the naysayers, the usual gang of idiots, are out there whining that it's going to cost an average of $10.2 billion a year. And you notice cost. Government comes at you with the assumption that all money is their money, and any of it that you don't have to pay them is a gift from them or cost to them. So $10.2 billion annually, and they're whining that we can't afford it. I want to know how many days it would take them to spend that money.
$10.2 billion?
Yep. And that number is going to have a decimal point on it because it's too easy if we don't.
Okay.
So how many days would it take them to, at the pace they're spending, to spend that $10.2 billion that they're whining about? All right, back to the very interesting market week and the very interesting things that are going on. Take it away.
Yeah. I wanted to talk about some numbers. There was a really nice surprise this week, but I'm going to get to that in a minute. First, I want to talk about housing. And we saw a really nice existing home sales report to end last week. I talked about it last weekend. That one centered on houses that are already existing, not on new homes. New homes make up less than 10% of all sales, and they showed a decline of 7.8% last month. And that decline, if you look at it year over year, it's 3.7%. However, statistics can be pretty tricky. Because if you look at the first 5 months of this year compared to the first 5 months of last year, sales are actually up about 3.7% when you compare those two time periods. So all of that decline was caused in the second half of last year. So we don't know what's going to happen in the second half of this year. And it kind of makes me curious if we'll see an uptick with mortgage rates being so low, home prices going up, but not quite at the same rate that they had been, and the economy remaining so strong. So that 7.8% on the surface looks like a terrible month, but it really doesn't mean anything when you look at the whole picture.
Whenever you impose an artificial cutoff date, end of a week, end of a month, whatever, you subject yourselves to the layout of the calendar, little rounding errors, In some seasons, it's particularly true. A holiday can upset things, like the number of layoffs. Sometimes they'll give you a number, and the holiday caused a lot of the unemployment offices to close one day that week. It's meaningless. But we have this saturation media that wants to give us numbers, numbers, numbers.
Especially negative numbers.
Especially negative, exactly.
So the other thing that this report showed was that sales are actually increasing in the South and the Midwest, and the slowdown was all in the West and Northeast. So that, remember that, because I have some more around that in a minute. So the Case-Shiller Price Index also showed a 3.5% increase in house prices year over year. Not the 6.5 we saw last year, but that's okay. Because houses long-term should increase at the rate of inflation, not at 7% a year. That's
6.5% is a self-correcting problem. The reason housing purchases slow down is they're going up too fast. So what happens? Demand eases a little bit. The price pressure eases a little bit. And we come right back down to a normal rate of increase.
There's also a lot of variance in the home data reporting by city. If you look into the data and look at the actual cities, prices are up in Tampa, Phoenix, and Las Vegas. And they're down in Seattle, San Diego, and L.A.
Huh.
Does anyone else see a trend here? It seems that overpriced, overtaxed bastions of Democrats, basically, are seeing prices decline, while conservative, affordable, low-tax areas are seeing price increases. Huh. I don't think that's a coincidence.
Who knew?
So just something to keep in mind, that that housing data, as everyone always says, location, 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 it's very specific to where you are looking at. And if you look at the national numbers, they are not necessarily going to add up to what we're seeing and what Angela and Howard talk about, which is Jacksonville is a very, very strong market right now.
Very vibrant market here.
Definitely. So the other bit of decent news was that the final revision of quarter one GDP came in unchanged at 3.1%. And while there's some movement in the underlying numbers, overall it was still a pretty good report. Personal consumption fell while business investment and exports increased. It's worth noting that corporate profits were higher than expected, despite the news claiming that we're in a corporate profits recession. Jobless claims also came in at 228,000, continuing their streak of below 300,000, which is a near an all-time record. I don't think we're quite at it, but we're near it. And last, the big positive surprise that I mentioned earlier was in personal income and personal consumption, which rose 0.5% and 0.4% respectively. Personal income is up 4.1% in the past year, while spending is up 4.2% because this is America. We always spend more than
Absolutely.
What we earn.
Absolutely.
And April, which last month, which also saw a jump of 0.5%, was revised higher to 0.6%. But this economy really isn't benefiting anyone,
no,
is
no,
it?
No, no, no. We need an economy that works for everybody.
It's a 1.1% increase in 2 months in personal income. That's I don't remember a time where
try
that's
to,
happened.
Yeah, try to just resurrect anything you've ever heard like that in your lifetime, and I promise you, you'd be back in the 80s.
Yeah, I mean,
hear anything like that.
I would imagine that over this recovery, that that number has probably averaged under 2%, and now we're seeing it over 4%.
Yeah.
That's significant.
It is very significant. In fact, real wages are falling, had been falling for 20 years, 30 years maybe.
Yeah, and now they're not only growing at a faster pace, but they continue to accelerate, which mm-hmm. is the really exciting part.
Yep. Well, look at what causes labor rates to go up.
Shortages.
Bingo.
And that's what we're seeing, no doubt about it.
Funny, isn't it, that the
it
law
does
of
take
supply
a while.
And demand works?
It takes a while for that data to filter through, but you had to figure it was coming.
Absolutely.
So,
much to no one's surprise, these things happen. You know, they call them economic rules because they're rules, not because they're suggestions. All right, want to hear some bad journalism? Oh, by the way, I've been thinking about it. I want to change the trivia question. How many hours will it take government to spend that $10.2 billion? How's
hours?
That?
Okay, yeah. Fair enough.
I actually like that question phrased that way much better. Here's a great one from this week. Chink in labor market armor? Jobless claims climb to 7-week high.
7-week high. Whoa.
227,000. My God, anything under 300,000 is good. Anything under 250,000 is practically unheard of. And this climbed to 227,000.
I think we've been under 250,000 for over 90 weeks, I want to say.
Yeah, I don't know. I may even have that here. Yeah, it doesn't care. But it's
I read
like
that this morning,
yeah,
but yeah,
it's like that.
It's in that.
All right, here's a part of it. What happened? Raw or unadjusted jobless claims increased last week, primarily in, similar to what you're talking about, California, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and New Jersey, and may have been tied to the end of the school year.
Oh.
Who knew?
Yeah.
By and large, new jobless claims have stuck to historically low levels, even as hiring has tapered off, and the number of Americans already collecting benefits sits near the lowest level since the early 1970s. Big picture, the strongest labor market in decades is propelling the U.S. forward in the face of rising headwinds, such as a trade fight with China, a weaker global economy, and sputtering growth among manufacturers and home builders. The economy will be okay so long as that continues. Is this the worst journalism in the history of America, or what? Oh, what are they saying? We can see no reason to expect a sustained increase unless the G20 summit is a disaster and the U.S. imposes tariffs on imports of Chinese consumer goods. Well, that was brilliant, wasn't it? Market reaction. Wink, wink, nod, nod, sleep, sleep. It's unfathomable, people. U.S. economy, this is another one, U.S. economy grew at a solid 3.1 rate in Q1. Now, guess what follows that? Semicolon. Sharp slowdown forecasted. Remember how many times in the last few weeks we've been reading the forecast for the GDP? Oh, it's going to drop to 2, 1.9, whatever. So it comes out at 3.1, I guess, and it was adjusted once a little bit. But then this was the final confirmation of the Q1 GDP that came out this week. And it came out right at the same 3.1 that they had estimated earlier. There is nothing wrong. For the entire year, GDP grew at, you ready for this? 3.9%, the best annual gain since 2015, which is an absolute lie. It's much better than that. Oh, we got a little bit more and then some other fun topics right after the break, so let's not go anywhere. Lines are open, 222-TALK. You're listening to the Banley Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Banley Financial Hour. I'm Steve Banley.
And I'm Adam Banley.
And our trivia question is still out there. The people who are complaining about the cost to the government of indexing capital gains, which I'm about to go into in depth, are complaining that the government would have a shortfall of $10.2 billion a year. And I say they're a bunch of whiny idiots, because how many hours will it take them to spend that money? All right, this has happened before over the years, but the article today is from Bloomberg, and it was dated this morning. And the whole concept of paying tax twice, which can happen with corporate dividends and with inflation.
Yeah, there's quite a few ways.
Double taxation. Yeah, there's a lot of things like that. And trying to eliminate them just seems to me to be a fair thing to do.
I don't know about that. You get taxed on your income, and then you pay a sales tax for everything you buy. So
yeah,
that's a big one.
Yeah, it is a big one. Anyway, this is the, I read the parts of the, it's a very short article by Bloomberg, and then I'm going to comment on some of it. First part, the White House is reportedly developing a plan to cut taxes on capital gains by indexing cost basis to inflation, effectively eliminating any taxes on appreciation attributable to inflation itself, which would be implemented by having the Treasury Department itself redefine how cost basis is calculated, which avoids the need and the challenge of getting Congress to approve. Well, every other time that I remember this, and I've been a proponent of it for decades, it's always been a proposal that was started at the congressional level, and you just know what happens when you start talking about anything like that at Congress. Congress is the place where good ideas go to die.
Well, I can already see the opposition to it also.
Sure.
It's only going to benefit the rich.
It's easy to demagogue. That's one of the big things. But I have been dealing with this subject in various ways since I can remember. All right, the next point. Notably, this is not the first time the measure has been proposed, as it was floated briefly last year and was considered as far back as President George H.W. Bush's administration. However, the proposal has reportedly floated back to the top with the prospective goal of implementing before President Trump faces re-election in 2020. The goal to push it through the 2020 is the first reason that I think this one might have a chance. Actually, it might be the second reason. The first reason being that when I first got wind of this thing coming up again was through Grover Norquist, and many of you recognize the name or the guy himself from Americans for Tax Reform, is it? I think so. And he's a very, very well-known figure in D.C. and a guy that was very, very instrumental in getting the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017 passed. Very, very powerful guy. And he doesn't mind pointing at people and using names for people in Congress who don't want to go along with tax cuts. So the proposal itself is reasonable conceptually as a way to shift capital gains to only real asset growth. And Bloomberg's exactly right about that. Also makes federal revenue itself less sensitive to inflation, though adaptations would have to be made to distort interest and depreciation deductions for inflation as well. And then that does get a little complicated. More on that later. But most people do understand the difference between real and nominal amounts of money. Nominal refers to an actual number of dollars. For instance, you buy something for $100 and sell it later for $200. You have a nominal profit of $100. But a real profit includes the inflationary value of the increase and subtracts it to get your real profit margin. So let's say you paid $100 for something, held it for a few years, and during that time, inflation amounted to 20%. You sell it for $200. You have a nominal profit of $100. But since 20% of that $100 was purely inflationary, you have a real profit of only $80, and that's what would be taxed. Well, to me, that just makes all kinds of sense. So Bloomberg says, nonetheless, the proposal itself is controversial, with analysts suggesting the proposal would reduce federal tax revenue by $102 billion over the next decade. That's where I got my 10.2. 86% of which would accrue only to the top 1% of households, and it's unclear how much additional economic growth and investment it would actually stir. What a crock. This is why the whiny left does what the whiny left always does, because it's so easy to demagogue these things. And it's just going to benefit the rich. And then, of course, you can bet that these analysts that were mentioned by Bloomberg come from the whiny, whiny segment of the society that hates the rich. Well, this is a big season, of course, for hating the rich. If you've paid any attention to TV the last week, you know just exactly what I'm talking about. So what's going to actually happen here is not entirely clear. And Bloomberg says that it's not clear for sure that the White House can do this without Congress. Now, a lot of people will read that and say, well, then why even try? I, of course, do not take any stock in that method of doing things. I say you go ahead and do it. The chances of you being challenged in court under the Trump administration are roughly, 100%. Good. I say, do it, take it to court, test it. If it doesn't pass, then we know exactly what we have to do. We either rewrite the bill and try it again, or you go right for a constitutional amendment. There are only a couple ways to get things done up there, and too much of D.C. will just not do it. It's going to be too difficult. It'll never work, on and on and on. You've heard it for the number of decades you've been around, just like I have. Now, I got some optimism myself, and here's a few reasons why. Having a businessman president steeped in real estate depreciation, capital gains, and inflation makes Trump the logical person to drive this current proposal. Two, the pure logic of not taxing inflation is so plain and simple that arguments to the contrary are difficult to sustain. Three, among the allies pushing this through is the aforementioned Grover Norquist from Americans for Tax Reform, who, as I said, is very powerful and instrumental in fixing our tax code and helping real, honest-to-goodness taxpayers. Four, the current crop of White House economic advisors are not Keynesian, unlike the 8 years that we've suffered through with the likes of Austin Goolsbee. This group understands their monetarists. They understand there's guys like Art Laffer, who practically invented part of the science of economics that actually works. They have the right advising now in the White House, and I think that's going to go a long, long ways toward getting this through. Next, having seen the success of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, remember what I said in April? The government experienced record revenues after cutting taxes. Happens every time. Many more elected Republicans now understand Economics 101 than did before that law was passed. And the public taste for tax cuts is still fresh despite the terrible job the administration did selling and educating the public. Adam and I were talking about this in the break a little bit. There's still so many people that do not understand that they got a tax cut until you quiz them on it. Anyway, there's a couple of reasons that I'm a little concerned also, naturally. They start with, of course, Nancy Pelosi, who just has a complete aversion to anything Trump-like passing between now and 2020, and she already got stung this week once, so she's going to be a real, real bear this week, this next month. The entire media complex, who can read through a complicated proposal that makes a lot of sense and pick out one incorrect sentence that says 86% of the benefit would accrue to the top 1% of earners. And the government is loath to use dynamic scoring for economic proposals, preferring the old static process. What do we mean by that? In a static system, which is used by the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, it says if, for instance, we've got X dollars worth of assets that are likely to be sold this year, that will all become capital gains and it will be taxable. But let's say that 30% of the average, 30% of the pool of money that would be sold will not be taxed because of inflation. Therefore, revenue will drop 30%. That's called static scoring. Dynamic scoring says, that X is not going to be what's sold this year. It's going to be X plus Y that's sold this year because there's so many people holding back assets that they won't sell just because their taxes are going to be too high. That means X plus Y minus the inflation plus times the tax rate will be a bigger pool of money under dynamic scoring than it would under static. So what would you do? I know what I'd do. We talked to a lot of people who won't sell assets because of the taxes, believe me. So there's a lot of complexity, and it will be super complicated. There's a lot of smart people in the Treasury. I think they can work out the details, and we will keep you posted because this will affect you. We'll be right back. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
In this segment brought to you by Robinson Landscape and Maintenance, give Troy a call at 662-9794. And again, a reminder of our trivia question. If the $10.2 billion, quote, cost of indexing capital gains will curtail some spending on behalf of the government, how many hours would they be without? In other words, how long would it take them to spend that money if they have it? If you were to guess the most domestic car,
most American car
on the road,
and we don't,
would be an American car, wouldn't you think?
You would think so, yeah.
You might be wrong.
Actually, you wouldn't be. Well,
you sort of would.
Yeah, it's debatable.
Funny, yeah, it's kind of a funny answer. It's kind of a funny question. Everybody should understand that there's no such thing as an American car or a German car.
Not anymore.
A Japanese car. No. Yeah. I don't know any dashboards that aren't assembled in India, for instance.
I have a list of the most American-made vehicles. It's top 15. And the number one is a very recognizable American brand that's owned by a foreign company.
Yeah. So
it's actually the Jeep Cherokee. It's built in Belvedere, Illinois. But the next three...
And by the way, a very nice car.
Yeah, not bad. I happen to have its big brother. The next three are built at a plant in Lincoln, Alabama, but that plant is owned by a foreign company called Honda. So it's the Odyssey, the Ridgeline, and the Passport. So the Japanese automaker Honda has three of the top five most American-made cars, which, again, this just gets more convoluted as you go down the list. It turns out that six are American brands. There's a bunch of Chevys, and then one Ford, the F-150, at number 13, built in Clay Como and Dearborn, Michigan. Missouri and Michigan. And there's actually a lot more Hondas on this list than anything else. So nine of the top 15 most American-made cars are owned by foreign companies. So very convoluted, but it just goes to show you what you said is correct. There really are no American-made or foreign-made cars. They're kind of produced all over the world, and yes, the corporate headquarters of some companies are in America and some are in Japan and some are elsewhere. But you look at Tesla, which is actually assembled in California, and none of them make the list because they buy so much of their parts from overseas. So go figure.
When you get down to buy American, there's only so much you can do.
Yeah, really is.
And let's face it, buying something with a foreign manufacturer's brand on it, you're still buying a lot of American.
Yeah, I guarantee you that plant in Lincoln, Alabama that makes Hondas employs way, way more Americans than some of the other companies that say the Teslas, that the parts manufacturers for Teslas employ tons of foreign people. So where are you doing more good spending your money?
Well, I wouldn't be too cautious based on that. Find a car you like, buy it.
Exactly.
And plus, they have just become so much better than they used to be. Every car maker is doing such a better job nowadays building cars. You can keep them for a long, long time. And it's, you know, I take this back to a component. I used to work many, many, many years ago for a muffler manufacturer. And they were in the process of developing the stainless steel muffler. Well, prior to that, there was a 3-year replacement cycle on mufflers, and they could predict with a great deal of accuracy which replacements were going to happen which year. So we actually manufactured ahead based on that demand. Well, all of a sudden, things are stainless steel, and the replacement cycle jumps to about 10 years or better, and all of the forecasting was gone. It was impossible to tell. And everyone knew, and we all talked about it, we are putting ourselves out of business because if we don't, somebody else is going to.
Mm-hmm.
It was quite an interesting thing. Now the car makers are having a significantly bad time between the demographics of people. Young people are not getting driver's licenses and buying cars at nearly the pace young people used to. And the cars are lasting so long, so the replacement cycle is large. So don't plan on the car business being the biggest growth business in the world for a while.
No.
Not going to happen.
Definitely not. I think people are looking at alternative modes of transportation more than we ever mm-hmm. have in history, because there's more available. Uber wasn't a thing 10 years ago, and now it is.
And what scares me is not the Uber so much. It's the driverless. I can see where driverless cars could do a good job by putting them on a highway with only driverless cars and sending them where they're going. But when you're on the roads with a bunch of people who are the most unpredictable things ever, I get real worried. But that's just me. I'm not giving up my car.
If we can send a rocket into space and have it land on a boat, we can certainly manage driverless cars. That's my thinking.
Count me out. You're going to have my Lexus when you pry my cold, dead fingers off the steering wheel. All right. You've heard it all the acronyms in the world, right? IRA, HSA. You all know what those are, don't you? Health savings accounts. Well, the administration has a new one, and I like this because it affects you, me, and everybody else. One of the biggest expenses we all have is obviously health care. Trump has announced the HRA, Health Reimbursement Arrangement. Now, I had never heard of this until a few days ago. I knew they were working on some of the small business stuff, but I didn't know how it was going to come out. Well, this rule would allow employers to offer HRAs to their employees to purchase insurance as an alternative to providing to their employees their own insurance policy. A lot of the things, particularly in places like union-negotiated policies, there's a lot of benefits that most people don't need, and a lot of them are very expensive. So the employers are now going to be able to offer to you, you go out and find an insurance policy that you like, and we'll reimburse you to get it. Pretty cool. What's the other part of this thing? The HRA funds are tax-free to you, and they're tax-free to the employer, just like when the employer provides it on a master policy. And the funds roll over from year to year, emulating the HSA. In an HSA, in a health savings account, you can use the funds in that account to pay your medical bills if you want to, but you do not have to. So if you can pay them out of your pocket and leave the HSA money in there, it rolls over, and it becomes another IRA for you when you hit 65 and can't use it anymore. And from that day on, you can either take it out with a penalty, or you can pay medical bills for the rest of your life out of the balance in there. But this is going to work. In other words, it's not a use it or lose it. Everybody's familiar with the cafeteria plans, which are use it or lose it. This is not one of those. More than 80% of employers currently offer their workers just one choice. And this rule will allow them to be much more flexible, and you never know how much you're going to get. Negotiate with the employer. They might give you enough money that you can not only pay your premiums, but you can also pay all the deductible out of your pocket if you want to, and all of that is not taxed to you. They're estimating that up front, they're going to get about 11 million workers and 800,000 businesses signing up for these HRAs. Now, that is pretty substantial. So it's going to improve choice, which is one of the things that we really care about, because we got to get the costs under control or in control, and you will be able to use this for dental care, premiums, and all kinds of stuff, eye care. You might be able to find a deal that would save you hundreds and hundreds of dollars a month. In fact, there's a leftover message on the computer in the studio here. It says, can you envision a private sector solution to health care that also eliminates health insurance? Why does it have to be government run? Well, my answer to that was, yes, I can envision it. No, it doesn't have to be government run. Government has to change the rules so the private sector can do this, either with an insurance or a reimbursement. And that's the first step that's going to happen here. The estimates from the administration so far, it's expected to be 50 to 80% cheaper than what's going on at the employer level now. Now, if let's say you get one that's 50% less than the person next to you, the employer then has the room to negotiate with you, bumping it up so you can take care of some of the other things. I think this is absolutely brilliant, and it will go a long ways toward retiring our old bugaboo called Obamacare.
We'll see.
Yeah. You've been hearing about these religious-based health. It's sort of an insurance policy, but it's a sharing thing where it's a network.
They advertise it on the station.
Yeah, they do. And that it's a network, and that in that network, if somebody gets a really bad one, the other people pitch in and pay for it. And it's getting bigger and bigger, and it's about $500 a month average savings. $10.2 billion takes our Congress 30.4 hours to spend. So they care so much, don't they?
Clearly.
You can't make this stuff up. See you next week. This is the Benly Financial Hour.